So anyway, people are still finding some space to sit. For those who need to go to the letting go room, otherwise known as a toilet. I like the way they say it in the United States. They call it the rest room. And the rest room is someone at work. You can always tell your boss to say, I'm working too hard, can I take a break? And he says, no. But you say, can I use the restroom? Say, yes. So you go into the restroom, you can meditate in there. It's a nice soft seat. You can take a cushion if you wish. And when you find a nice restroom, if the boss tells you off for staying in there too long, you can always say that you were constipated. It's not lying, but don't tell him it's nothing to do with your tummy, to do with your brain was constipated. No good ideas were coming out. But anyway, so those are just a few words. Are we ready to record and play? Are we ready to go? Yes, okay, great. So now for the talk this evening, what shall I talk about? Okay, I just come back from teaching over in UK and in Oslo, and also made the opportunity to visit my family over there. I still got a brother and some nephews and grandnephews and nieces, and they all, I think you know what they call me. They call me Munkle. And that's gone to the next generation of my brother's grandchildren. They always call me Munkle Brahm. Which is quite nice, it's cute. But anyhow, I was just talking to one of my nephews. He seems to be one of the most spiritual of that family. But you know, he's got a family to look after. He has bills to pay, children to allow to grow. And I said that carefully, to allow to grow. One of the questions which I was asked a lot when I was in UK, because many of the Buddhists over there, they have children, and they want to know, how can we look after our children? Should we take them to the Buddhist center every day? Should I brainwash them into being Buddhists? Should I make sure that if they go to the temple, then they get extra food so they can look like me? Or how should we bring up our children? And one of the pieces of advice which I heard a long time ago, and I've been saying this to everybody who has children, that only two things to teach your children, if you're a Buddhist, I don't care, Mahayana, Theravada, Hinayana, or my type of Buddhism, Mahayana, whatever Buddhist you are, please encourage them to always ask questions. That is why today I saw one of our members at Bodhinyana Monastery, and I asked him if he was coming tonight, and I asked him, is he going to ask a question? And good old Eddie, sitting in the back there, he did come. He said, I asked too many questions. I said, no, because it's a symbol of encouraging questioning. So you don't just sit here and listen to rubbish. You actually can question the teacher, whoever's here. And that actually makes the teacher put more effort and wisdom and kindness into their teachings. So the talk can be even better, we hope. So that's why questioning is always so important. It's not like just to believe what you're told here. Please ask those questions. Sometimes I've got some very tough questions from people. And when they ask those tough questions, it makes me sort of see deeper into the meditation, into my practice, so that you can sort of give better answers. When you don't ask those questions, it's not helping yourself, it's not helping whoever's teaching up here, whether they're a monk or a nun or a layperson, because when you ask those questions, it does make it much better for everybody. And a good example of that was, I only usually say this story during retreats, but you know, sometimes you've heard me talk about some of the deep meditations. We call them the jhanas. You don't have to know totally what they are for this moment, but they're very powerful deep states of mind. And so we were just talking today about the Vietnamese translation, which we don't think was really authorized, of Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond. I think they gave it the nickname, a Meditator's Handbook. And even that book, just, I remember that sometimes people, you know, we teach that, but then sometimes people would ask me, now Ajahn Brahm, you teach all this stuff, especially in the retreats, the deep meditations, can you do it yourself? Can you enter the jhanas? And that is one of our rules as monks and for nuns as well. We're not allowed, permitted by, you know, the Buddha. It's our rule of Vinaya. If you want to check it up, it's the Paccitya number 8. We're not allowed to claim to lay people. We can complain, we can, not complain, but to claim to any person other than a monk or a nun whether we have experienced those deep states of meditation or even our stages of enlightenment. We're supposed to keep that quiet. There's many good reasons for it, but in particular, sometimes it gets a bit frustrating. I can understand what it must be like for you. Who is doing these teachings? Can these monks who keep talking about jhana all the time, do they know what they're talking about? So many times you're not allowed to ask questions. But then trying to push off the question, saying, no, I'm not allowed to give an answer. To me, that was frustrating. And I could see other people, they thought maybe he's just making this up. So anyway, I remember once, because people asked me, you asked the questions, you pressured me, I decided to give an answer. And to give an answer which took the question to a much deeper level and also was a nice little talking point. I wouldn't have done this if people hadn't have kept on asking me. So eventually, I remember first of all saying this in Sri Lanka when some monks asked me, Ajahn Brahm, you're well known as a teacher of jhana, of these deep meditations. But Ajahn Brahm, can you enter those jhanas? Can you do it? You know what I answered? Well, I don't think you're really interested, are you? Of course, I was looking at you. One of the things which I do when I give talks, I do like to keep eye contact with you, because then I know whether you're interested or you're getting bored. So I gave the answer in public. It was recorded, it was filmed. I said, Ajahn Brahm cannot enter jhana. That's what I said. And many people were a bit shocked. Other people who knew me said there's something more to this. They knew I was a very sneaky monk. I say sneaky in a good sense. So I said to them, Ajahn Brahm cannot enter jhana. Ajahn Brahm has to disappear first. When I disappear and vanish, and all this doing stuff stops, then jhana happens. But I can't do it. I don't know how many times I've said for the deep meditations, you have to learn to relax to the max, which means you're not doing anything. Even I remember Ajahn Chah telling me, he was saying that please never meditate, if you're really into meditation, don't meditate trying to get something. Meditate trying to get rid of things, trying to allow things to disappear, allow things to cease. He said that's how to meditate. Meditate being still. If you're still, you can't do things. You're just standing there or sitting there. And that is very radical. It's so radical that I don't know if I should be teaching this, but anyway, I'm too tired to stop. One of the first teachings which Ajahn Chah gave, this is my teacher Ajahn Chah in Thailand, I was with him for 8.5 years. And one of the teachings he gave, I never really understood for years. When I heard it, I thought Ajahn Chah was basically crazy. It never made any sense. That was with deepest respect to a teacher. I'm sure that many things which I say here, which you've heard many times, you think, oh, that's rubbish. That's not true. The jokes are okay, but the rest was a bit sort of rubbishy. But that was the story. And eventually I put it down in one of the books which I wrote. And I include it in there, even though it wasn't the right place in that particular book. But I needed it to be published somewhere. And that was the story of the mango orchard. It was the story which Ajahn Chah said the first months which I was a monk with him over in northeast Thailand. It's about 48 years ago now. Oh yeah, it's... Oh no, I won't say that. I won't say that Monday, the 5th of December, it'll be my 48th anniversary as a monk. There's much better birthdays. This is like a monk birthday. So don't go to Bodhinyana Monastery, because next week I'm out all the time going to some place, people's place for dana. But nevertheless, that I remember him telling the story of the mango orchard simile. He said that his monastery, Wat Nong Pa Phong, was a mango orchard. Well, those mango trees have been planted by the Buddha. Now straight away I thought, hang on, I was a scientist, a theoretical physicist. There's no way that the Buddha could have planted mango trees and they're still alive 25 centuries later. So for the first time I started to turn off from this simile. Then he said those mango trees were planted by the Buddha, and Wat Nong Pa Phong, Ajahn Chah's monastery, had so many of these mango trees. And they're all laden just with so many mangoes, all ripe, and so sweet and juicy. You can't get mangoes like that in any shop. The most delicious mangoes in the universe. The trees planted by the Buddha. But then he said, there's only one way to get one of those mangoes, to be able to eat them. You cannot climb the tree. You cannot shake the tree to make the mangoes to fall. You cannot throw a stick up at the tree to get a mango. In these days, you can't get a cherry picker and to climb up to get the mango. You can't get one of these fireman's ladders to get the mango. You can't get a helicopter or a drone or any other way you may think to get those mangoes. There's only one way to get a mango from the trees planted by the Buddha, and that is you've got to sit underneath that tree perfectly still and then open out your hand and a mango will fall in. Do you think that's possible? That's rubbish. Honestly, with deepest respect to Ajahn Chah, I thought that was the most stupid simile I've probably ever heard. Be careful, because when you think it's a stupid simile, it's amazing just how powerful and deep and accurate those similes become. I thought it was just a stupid simile because it never made sense to me, because my meditation wasn't that deep. My understanding of Buddhism wasn't that deep. You know, I'll just become a monk, you're just starting off your investigation. And there's so many times when it's like you saw a mango on a beautiful tree, you try to throw something up to get it down, to shake the tree or do whatever you could to get those mangoes, but they never fell. And so eventually, you were just sitting quietly, very still, because that's what you do in meditation, it's fun to do. The greatest joy is getting those wonderful meditations. It's weird, because sometimes you think that pleasure is out there in the world. Like at the moment, I did see on the news broadcast that people are really excited about World Cup soccer, especially if your team won. If your team lost, oh, terrible suffering. And apparently there are 36 teams playing in this World Cup soccer. 35 teams are going to go home losers. And one team will go home happy for just a couple of years, then there'll be another competition, then they will lose. There's so much suffering in sport. I don't know why people get involved in it. But nevertheless, people find that's kind of happy. What will make you happy? What do you want? Because somebody suggested this is the talk for this evening. I asked, what should I talk about this evening? And they replied, whatever you like. So I threatened to give a talk titled, whatever you like. If I was a wizard with my wand and I could give you a wish, what would you want? Honestly, would that make you happy? So instead, these deep meditations where you get very still, that gives you more happiness and pleasure, give it the right word, pleasure, than you've ever known before. And nothing can compare to it. In seeing beautiful parts of nature like sunsets or just the birth of a child, your child. I don't know what else you find really moving and deep and powerful in your life, but those meditations far exceeded those. But each one of those meditations is like eating one of those mangoes. You can't actually do it. So many people were trying to meditate and trying to meditate and trying to meditate, and they just get frustrated. Even the meditation which I just taught, how did I teach it? You look in the body, you relax the whole body with kindness. You know another word for kindness, another explanation of kindness, is this term to open the door of your heart to whatever's happening, no matter what. And just no matter what is really important. It's what we call unconditional kindness, unconditional openness, unconditional mindfulness, if you like. To be aware of what's happening right now, no matter what it is. If you can do that, instead of trying to get something or get somewhere, then you're knowing how to be peaceful and how to be still. That's why you can't do it. You have to get out of the way and let it happen. A similar teaching was, you know, if any of you are doctors or nurses or carers in any which way, maybe just looking after an elderly person in your family who needs your assistance and help. Remember, just if you are even a doctor, you should never think the main priority is to cure your patient. When you look at it, it's impossible to cure anyone. If you know the cancer does get into remission, they usually die of something else. How many people here have decided they're never going to die? We all have to eventually go. It's just, it's how we live and what we do with those years which is the most important, not how long we can put off the inevitable. Imagine some of you. How many people ask for a lottery number from good monks? Would you like to win the lottery? No one said yes, I won't tell you the lottery numbers. I'm only joking, because I know there's something much more than being rich. Instead of trying to cure your problems through the power of money, it's much nicer to be able to cure all the problems, health problems, family problems, life problems, meaning problems, finding some meaning in your life. It's much better to cure those problems than not even trying to cure them, but by caring for your body, caring for life, caring for the people in your life. That's one of the reasons why for doctors, nurses, psychologists, therapists, monks, nuns, our job is not to cure you of your defilements, it's to care for you. Sometimes that wears me out, caring, but it's worth being worn out by giving something which is much better than wisdom, kindness. There's not many things better than wisdom, but kindness is. That kindness, that actually is, it's like kindness is like COVID. It's contagious. When you see other people being kind, then it just rubs off on you. I think that's one of the reasons why our Buddhist society, Mr. President, is amazing in this world. Honestly, if you go over to the UK and you go over to Norway and you see many people, I don't know, from Poland. I was almost hijacked. I was going to one of the talks in London and there's a lot of people outside, about a dozen of them. There were a delegation from some Polish Buddhist society with a big invitation, another one, to go over to some place in Norway for something or other. But why? And they know about BSWA and it's very, very, very successful, you'd be surprised. How many people just on a, you know, just a short tour to London and to Oxford and to Oslo, how many people said they listened to these talks, the talks we're giving now, and how much it means to them, and how it's just helped them with so many problems and difficulties in their life. It didn't quite happen this trip, but I know the trip before I went to London, there's this Afro-English lady came running towards me in Paddington Station. Now Paddington, the big station with the trains going everywhere, running towards me and just, I thought she was going to attack me. but then she said, "You're the YouTube monk." And I said, "Well, what do you mean?" And before I could answer, she said, "Yes, you are." She recognized me. She said, "What are you doing in Paddington? You're supposed to be in Australia." But it's very lovely to go to so many different countries and people come and see you. And they come and see you and they say that you saved my life. You know, this particular time, I remember just in Oslo, you know, an elderly couple came all the way from United States, just for the weekend, and after the retreat was over, flew back again. That's crazy, was it? Just because they needed to see me. They'd seen our monks on our YouTube channel. There's an opportunity seeing face to face, public, real. So there's something going on there. But anyway, that's sort of the pleasure, the happiness, the sense of freedom, the sense of understanding. That doesn't come from curing problems, from caring for people. And it comes from yourself, from caring for yourself. That caring is not doing something. It's kind of natural to care. It's like when I've got nothing else to do, I'm not trying to achieve anything. You're not trying to create something or make something happen. Of course, you know, you're with your friends. You care for them. And it's in that caring that all these problems kind of end. It's powerful. When I was, even the deep meditation, it's not what you do, it's what happens when you care for your body and you care for your mind, that's all. That's why the stillness people know about, but the opening your hand is like caring. Or one of those other similes which I use. You know, of the donkey and the carrot simile. I think, if you've been on one of my retreats, you know this simile, because that's where I usually use them. But I'm on the subject now, so I might as well do the donkey and the carrot simile as well. And I use this to show how not to meditate and actually how to meditate and get these beautiful results. The donkey and the carrot was a donkey is one of the most stubborn animals. They used to use them in Europe a lot. I've seen them used in India as well. I remember just seeing this poor donkey pulling a cart and the owner just whipping it with a stick. I really felt so sad for the donkey, but our bus passed by so fast, there's nothing you could do. But please remember, that is not the way to get a donkey to pull a cart. The only way to get the donkey to pull a cart is to tie that stick on the donkey's neck. The string on the end of the stick, and on the end of the string, a carrot. If you live in Malaysia, I wouldn't put a carrot on the end of the stick. I'd put a durian. Because people in Malaysia like durians. So imagine what happens. That Malaysian donkey sees a durian on the end of the stick. And that donkey will go towards the durian because it likes to eat it. But you know, the stick is tied to the donkey's neck, string on the end of the stick, durian in front of the donkey's mouth. When it goes towards the donkey, so when the donkey goes towards the durian, or carrot if it's in a European country, he can see the carrot, but the carrot's always 2 foot in front of the donkey's mouth. Which means he runs after that carrot and still that carrot is 2 foot in front of the donkey's mouth. I usually pause when I tell this simile because many people can relate to that. All the sorts of things which you seek for in life, the things you work hard for. Have you ever noticed like that fulfillment, that happiness, that enough money to retire, enough things all settled so they retire, getting your family all settled, your kids all settled? You can sometimes see it. It's almost there. But you can't really catch it, ever. There's always something to be fixed up, something to be settled, something to be worked towards. That's why most people's lives can be well described as chasing carrots or durians. You're almost there, like many people. I shouldn't say this, but nevertheless I started, so here we go. It's just like many people when they retire. They worked hard all their life, and they got a nice little income. Maybe they got a pension, maybe they got a lovely house. Then they can retire. And then what do? They volunteer. And they still have to work hard. Really good on you. You volunteer to look after our Buddhist society. And then you think, I'll just get it ready and do my bit and then afterwards I can retire again. But honestly, that all of you people here who work for our Buddhist society, yeah, you can retire, but you can't ever fully retire. You still have to work somehow or other to help out here, help out there, which is a wonderful thing to do. But nevertheless, it's like you can almost catch the carrot, but it's just always a little bit in front of you. So anyway, the right way to get that carrot or that durian is you run as hard as you possibly can after that carrot or durian. Doesn't matter how fast you run, the carrot is always roughly the same distance in front of your mouth. Say 2 foot. But then the donkey, the wise Buddhist donkey, who come to the BSWA, who understand how to catch the carrots of life, you stop. You put on the brakes. And as you stop and you do nothing, you just stand there, that carrot swings away from you. Exactly. And when I don't know who that was, but anyway, when it does swing away, when it does swing away from you, you groan. That's why many people, when I teach them how to meditate, they say, oh, my meditation was much better before we came here. Because you stopped. We need that patience. So we'll just wait a little while. And then that carrot goes so far away from you. When it gets to the top of its trajectory, it's held on by the string. It can't go too far. It goes way away, further than it's ever been before. And then what happens to the carrot? It starts swinging towards you. It swings closer and closer and closer. It gets to its normal place, 2 foot in front of your mouth. But then the momentum is coming really fast towards your mouth. All you do is be still. Like Ajahn Chah saying, sit still under the mango tree. And as it comes even closer to you, there's one last piece of advice. It says, Buddha, open up your hand, like opening your heart, being kind. And if you're a donkey, don't think about opening out your hand, opening up your heart. Open your mouth to let the let the carrot swing in. I've known donkey. Have you ever seen a donkey? They've got this enormous big teeth. So you have to remember that last bit of kindness. Open the door of your mouth, and then a carrot can come in. And that's how these things are actually experienced. This is like spiritual truths. This is things, again, I never thought that what Ajahn Chah said had any sense. The donkey and the carrot, I invented that one. And it's a very accurate simile of just how these deep states of peace and meditation, enlightenment, actually happen. You're sitting down perfectly still, opening up your hand or your heart, and these things come to you. They come as a result of stillness and kindness. Those two together create the causes. These amazing insights and understandings to happen. And if that does happen, then, you know, you become incredibly wise and peaceful and happy. You understand whatever happens to you in your life, yeah, you all get sick. Actually, it's weird. I keep on saying this, that everybody gets sick. We know that I've just been pushing myself as usual over in Norway and in UK. I never get sick these days. It's weird. I've never had the COVID. I've never had anything. So I can be able to serve the BSWA. Thank you, body. A lot of times it is because if ever I do get tired or a pain or an ache or something, I just focus on it and heal it myself. It's kind of weird, but it's one of that parts of meditation and Buddhism, about Buddhism and health and healing, which kind of fascinates me. It's one of those byproducts. Sometimes people come here, they have things like depression. You know, I never get depressed, even though, you know, you have lots and lots of work to be done. Sometimes things go wrong. Welcome to life. Part of life is allowing things to go wrong and learning from them. Sometimes you get criticized. Wonderful, thank you. Sometimes that criticism is deserved. As I was taught by Ajahn Chah, he used to tell me, if anybody calls you a dog, it's one of the worst things they could ever call you in Thailand. There's worse things over here. I remember some of those really bad curses. The worst one, actually the second worst one, I remember hearing this in an airport. That's one of the reasons I love going to airports. Sometimes, you know, you do talk to people, you've got nothing else to do, the plane is late or something, you get some really interesting information. And this is this, he was a Middle Eastern guy, we're having a religious discussion, he said, the two worst curses in the Middle East. If you really want to upset somebody, you really don't like them, and you want to curse them. The second worst curse was, may the fleas of 1,000 camels infest your armpits. I never said that, I'm just quoting it, okay? From somebody else. So please don't say that to your partner. May the fleas of 1,000 camels infest your armpits. But the worst one which he told me, and that's the reason I tell that second worst one, was may you get everything you want as soon as you want it. That's a curse. If you think about that, contemplating, if that happens, whatever you want, it comes to you straight away. What do you want? It's not all good stuff, is it? Sometimes your boss may keep you at work this weekend. I wish my boss died. You call me your boss. I'm sure that that's happened to you a few times. I went out to Brum. Why can't he stay in England or something? Why can't he sit under a mango tree and the mango fall on his head and knock him out for a few weeks? That's normal, just, you know, being sort of any type of relationship, any type of being together. Sometimes you have terrible thoughts. Am I right? Are you sure? You have perfect thoughts all the time. Your lovely wife over there. But anyhow, just you get what you want as soon as you want it. The point was as soon as you want it. Which means that when a desire comes up, a want comes up, it's there for you straight away. The whole point of life, of working for it, is gone. If that ever happens to you, if you become some heavenly being after a while, it's hopeless. But anyway, that the nicest thing is to have no wants at all. To be free, to be at peace. And I often ask people, because I've done this myself, sometimes you ask yourself, what are the happiest times of your life so far? In all of the years you've been alive, those moments when you felt so content and happy. Those are the moments when you are sitting somewhere, lying somewhere, standing somewhere. And if somebody was next to you and said, would you like to be anywhere else in the whole world? Would you like to be with somebody else? Or with not the people you're with? Would you like even the weather to change, the time to change, you to be able to change? You're totally content. Just happy to be here. Not wanting to change anything in the whole universe. Moments of pure contentment and being at ease with this moment and with your life. If ever you could say that, the closest you are to that, moments of contentment are some of the biggest happinesses in your life. Are you happy to be here? Or would you like the talk to finish? To be honest. So anyway, these are like just some moments of contentment and happiness. Be able to sit still under a mango tree and be amazed that the more still you are, the more likely it is that mango falls. Knowing how to catch the carrots. Knowing that caring is more important than curing. I care for my body. Because you care for it, it doesn't get sick. So all these little things are teaching some of the most beautiful teachings of the Buddha. The teachings just how to be at peace, no matter what happens to you in life. There are always going to be difficulties and problems, but of course, that's where we learn. Whenever there is a difficulty or problem, I always remember to regard it as my teacher. When we had the difficulties with mosquitoes in those early years as a monk in Australia, they were really bad. When I asked Ajahn Chah, can we have some mosquito coils Or can we have some lotion to put on our skin? Can we get eaten alive by mosquitoes? And his advice was something much better than some chemical to burn or chemical to put on your skin. He said, from now on, please regard those mosquitoes as Ajahn mosquitoes. Those are your teacher. He wasn't trying to cure the problem. He was telling us to learn from the problem. And that was just a start of something, even when it was very noisy. Can you still meditate when there's noise? If there is noise, please call it Ajahn noise. And a good example of that, one of the monks of Bodhinyana Monastery, he asked me many years ago, his brother was coming through Australia, can his brother stay at Bodhinyana Monastery? I say, well, there's no objection, but there's nowhere to stay. You know, all the rooms are always taken. Every time we build a hut, it's somebody goes into it. So I said, there's no free space. He said, it's my brother. We grew up together. He can share the room with me. The two of you in a small kuti. He said, yeah, with my brother. And I said, look, you're both getting on in years. I'm sure you snore. What happens if your brother snores as well? And that's when this monk said, I figured that all out. I'm going to go in there and I'm going to go to sleep first. If I go to sleep first, my brother won't be able to, and I won't be able to hear my brother snoring. He'll hear my snoring, won't be able to go to sleep, so he won't snore. Or something like that. And so, but it didn't work out like that. They shared this room together, a small room, 3 meters by 2.4 meters. And apparently the brother fell asleep first and was a heavy snorer. You don't know when you are snoring. I do remember just teaching this small group of prisoners over in the jail in Canning Vale some years ago. And one of the prisoners fell asleep and started snoring. When he started snoring, he suddenly woke up and said, somebody's snoring, who was it? It was him. But anyhow, what happened was his brother was snoring very loudly and he couldn't ignore it. And so eventually he remembered that teaching of Ajahn Chah. Whatever's your problem, call it your teacher. So he called the snoring of his brother Ajahn snoring, Ajahn noise. And then what happened next? That he said, well, how can I just accept this? Make peace with it. Make peace, be kind, be gentle with his brother snoring. So what he did, he used his imagination. And you know, he was a highly educated European monk. So he started imagining his brother snoring like some state-of-the-art, cutting-edge music which defied all conventions and which was just so innovative that it had no rhythm, that it had no sort of structure. It's like destructuring music. Like you see some of the designs in some of these buildings we have, like the RAC centre which we pass on the freeway every time, the Perth, what do they call it? It's owned by the RAC, but it's got Perth Arena, yeah, whatever it is. But anyway, you see it from the freeway every week when you go past it, and it's got no straight lines anywhere. So it's like destructuring, challenging the formality of music and seeing a music which had no structure at all. And that was his brother snoring. For whatever. And so after a while, he could appreciate the lack of form of musical snoring. And it turned into something very delightful. really peaceful and beautiful. You can never predict what sound was going to come out of his brother's mouth or nose next. It was exciting, but sort of calming. And apparently he said that's the last thing he remembered. When he woke up in the morning, he fell fast asleep just by remembering that that noise was going to teach him something amazingly powerful. How to make peace with such noise. So these little insights which we get can solve so many difficulties and problems of our life. We don't try and cure the problem, we learn from it. We care from it, understand it. And when we understand it, it's gone. For those of you who have gone to Ajahn Bhamani or my sutta classes, you know this. There is this kind of figure in Buddhism, like a devil, but I wouldn't call him a devil. Call him like Mara, M-A-R-A, Mara. And Mara would come and scare the Buddha before he became enlightened, trying to tempt him, trying to disturb him, anything to stop him getting enlightened. And how Mara was defeated was just by the Buddha or the monk or the nun or the lay person just seeing Mara and saying, I know you, Mara. Just that knowledge. And then Mara had to bend his head, turn around and walk away. The president knows me. And then Mara has to leave. You don't have to worry with Mara here though, because this place was built in a wonderful suburb called No La Mara. Anyone in Malaysia, Singapore know that you add "la" to something and it means to emphasize, it means really no Mara. That's when Dr. K.C. Dhammananda, when I told him we just managed to build a place over here in Nola Mara, he said, Nola Mara, what a great name. It means no La Mara. So you don't have any problem with Mara. Except we do have a woman staying at Bodhinyana whose name is Mara. But she's a very nice woman. She's stayed many times. Just happens to be her nickname, that's all. Anyway, so that's actually how to care, not to cure, to learn rather than get rid of, how to be patient, be able to sit still and find incredible peace when you have this beautiful open heart. So the title of the talk this evening is called Open Heart Surgery. The real open heart surgery, or something else, whatever you want. Okay. So thank you for letting me talk. I don't know if it was really structured and never planned anything anyway. But now's the opportunity for questions if you have one. Maybe not questions, but question. Maybe pushing my luck to find two questions, or three, or four. Anyone have a question here? Come on, Eddie.
Okay, I ask a question, Ajahn Brahm.
Yeah.
Ajahn Brahm. You were talking about the donkey, you know, chasing the carrot.
Yeah.
Isn't it, that's a human, it happens to not only donkeys, to all of us, isn't it? We're always chasing something, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. And in the process of the chasing, we go through a lot of difficulties, you know? All right? Yeah.
Yeah.
In the Dhammapada, Ajahn Brahm, he did mention the Dhammapada, contentment is the greatest happiness.
Yeah.
Contentment is crazy,
yeah.
But so compared to chasing and contentment, it's hard to be contented, isn't it? Though it's the greatest happiness.
No, it's learning how to be contented.
You have to learn to be contented, yeah.
No, you have to disappear to be contented. See? He's silent now. So that's where we disappear, our sense of self, who we are, vanishes. Then we don't need to do anything anymore. We don't need to do anything anymore. Then the silence, the peace, is natural. Mm-hmm. I mean, look, you're coming on to things like holidays soon, many of you. What are you going to do in your holidays? Wouldn't it be wonderful just to sit at home and do absolutely nothing? Can you do that? Relax. Many of you got a garden. It's a nice time of the year to be out in the garden. Sunny, warm. Sit out in the garden and learn how to do nothing. Just sit and enjoy. I said this years ago, sometimes people go out in their garden with some music or an Ajahn Brahm tape or something else. That's not doing nothing. Sit out there and just listen to the birds or the silence, whatever's happening. And don't go there thinking how you can improve the garden. Just care for it as it is. Appreciate where the weeds are. And it's wonderful, you have nice weeds in the garden. Those weeds are very happy being there. Why should we just, you know, criticize those weeds aren't supposed to be there, these other flowers are supposed to be there? That's like criticizing LGBTQIA+. You're not supposed to be here. Or people with disabilities, not supposed to be here. Little thoughts in your mind, that's not supposed to be here. Just let those weeds be. Just for a day or two. You can actually weed them later on if you wish to, but just for a day, just appreciate who they are, what they're doing there. And that's actually where we learn so much. We make peace with things. If you think you have to make your garden absolutely perfect, all the weeds got rid of, all the grass mowed, all the trees watered, all of the rubbish taken away, was that ever perfection? You tie yourself out that way. That's why I know we try, and poor old Bill, just looking after Dhammaloka, works very hard trying to make this a beautiful place. And it's wonderful, and not just you, but all the other volunteers who come here. What you do is amazing. But it's never perfect. There's always something wrong. Every week. You know what was wrong today? We had no light in our washroom. So what do? We don't complain. We fixed it. So anyway, that's not a complaint to the management. So you're off the hook. It's only a little light. So anyway, the world is never perfect. But it's beautiful. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So I don't mind, in other words, we have to learn to be contented, say,
yeah,
instead of chasing all the time, you know.
Yeah, indeed.
Because a lot of us, if we're always more interesting, you know, more, you know, to chase, you know,
yeah,
you know.
But when you get to our age, when you get to our age, Eddie, we're too tired to chase things anymore.
Abhidhamma, contentment is the greatest happiness.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, I've got some questions online. We'll just do a couple, we won't go on for too long. I did promise the last time I was here that our caretaker, Nick, that we would try and finish by 9 o'clock. So we have five questions here in 4 minutes. What do you do when you are oversensitive, be it sadness or joy, others or myself? Always sensitive reaction or tears. How to protect your sensitivity without losing it? Compassion? Yeah, do some meditation. You can be highly sensitive, but you don't react. There's a lot of difference between sensitivity and reacting. Sensitivity, we know, but it's just not worthwhile, just reacting. So you have restraint. From Indonesia, some people said the last thought before dying that determines our next rebirth. Please explain if it is true from Buddhism perspective. What if we were negative before dying? We made many good karma throughout our life. That'd be really unfair, wouldn't it? You know, you just come to our Buddhist society, you tidy it up, you look after it, you give lots of donations, you serve on our committee, and just the last moment you have some bad thought, just by bad chance. And all that hard work was for nothing. You get reborn as a worm in a pile of dung. Of course it can't work like that, because the last thought, that is an inaccurate translation, it's the last process of thinking. And it's not, death is not a moment. death is over many minutes. If you've ever been with somebody who's dying and been with a doctor, they've got all instruments on them at the time, you see that things turn off slowly. I remember being with one of our members a long time ago, and you know, he was dying, and so there was no prospect of any sort of recovery. So the doctor did ask, can we turn off the life support? And it was, you know, just a pretty easy question. It turned off things just one by one over 5 or 10 minutes. So you can see that actually the death was happening slowly. It's a process, it's not an event. So anyway, your last thoughts, it's the last series of thoughts. And those last series of thoughts, you can't sort of manufacture them. It's just that's how you've been thinking all your life. That's how you've been behaving all your life. You know the old story. I didn't tell any funny stories about the rich businessman from Colombo in Sri Lanka. And he'd only go to the temple on Waisak Day. That's our holy day. And so he was fed up with going to the temple anyway, but he thought he might as well. Everything else was closed out at that time. But then he heard this Dhamma talk by this monk, a very senior monk, who said, your last thoughts are the most important. You have beautiful last thoughts, you're bound to go to heaven. And he asked the question, what's an example of really nice thoughts? And he said, thinking about the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. What we call the triple gem. That's one of the best thoughts to have. So he's a very clever man, and he thought, I've got a really good idea how I can, what he said, beat the system. So he had 3 sons at home. He renamed them Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, because he knew they would have to be there at his bedside when he died. That was the tradition. And so it happened a few years. So he said, now I know I'm going to be thinking of Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha when I die. So now I don't have to go to the temple ever again. Don't have to give any donations, alms. I don't have to keep my precepts anymore. I can just do whatever I like, because I've got a guaranteed way of getting to heaven without having to be good. And it was all happening just perfectly. He was sick. He was dying. It wasn't that painful. He knew he had to die one day. And his 3 sons were next to him, Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. And so as he was looking at his 3 sons, he kept on thinking, Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha. As he was getting closer and closer to the moment of death, Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha. Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha. And then he just had a thought, because his business, he owned a shop in the Gaul Road. And he thought, if my 3 sons are here, who's looking after my shop? And that's when he died. I like that story, because it just said you can't beat the system. If you've been like that all your life, that's how you're going to think when you die. Anyway, Ajahn often mentioned trust the process. How do we get past our mental processes and formations and access that? Oh, it's just the process is just another path. Understand that when that you stop and the durian or whatever it is just starts swinging away from you, you know it's going to come back again. You know, just trust the natural process. And when you stop, things must get still. When you care, things actually heal. That kindness and that stillness, you know that works. You just have to trust in the process. Means knowing what patience is. I don't know, we were in a traffic jam. John is here somewhere. The traffic jam's on the way here today, on the freeway, don't know why. But anyway, trust the process. The process is the car always moves forward. It's moving forward, it must eventually get to Nolamara. Doesn't matter how late it is. Okay, I'll just 2 minutes over. Every time I have a conversation with anyone, I'm somehow trying to always only prove my point and trying to be right rather than actually listening to what the other person is trying to say. How do I let go of this? How do I become less judging? How do I let go of this ego? And how can I train myself to actually listen to people? Did you listen to that? I hope you did, because you do listen to people. Sometimes we're far too critical of ourselves. So you have a conversation, you may not listen to them at the time, but whatever they say goes into your brain, you remember it, just like that thing with Ajahn Chah telling me about the mango orchard simile. I didn't believe that at the time, so I tried to forget it. But you know that I remembered that years and years after he said it. After I rejected it, it actually went in there somewhere. And then when I was ready for it, it came up and I learned from it. So the ego, yes, it does. You listen to things like Buddhism or the BSWA and go on retreats and your sense of self get less and less and less. You can't help it. It just was what happens. As you get less and less, you hear more and more. And this process happens gradually. Don't be in a rush. As I said to people even in my last retreat, and I mentioned this over in Norway, I said, when I teach retreats, I usually tell people, especially long retreats, 9 days or something, to please do not get enlightened on the first couple of days. Otherwise, you're going to have nothing left to do for 7 days. That's only a joke. Anyway, last question. My ex-partner is not able to trust in me and us once again. I did the AFL lesson, acknowledge, forgive, learn, myself and us. Still, she thinks it won't work again. There was only misunderstanding. Any advice, please? The acknowledge, forgive, learn thing. Forgiveness is okay. But how about the parole, AFPL? Acknowledge, forgive, parole, and learn. Parole is when you give people, say, 1 year's parole. If you mess around again, then you have to go back to jail. In a relationship, parole is, look, for 1 year, just don't commit to me yet, but see if we can have some sort of arrangement so you have all my passwords on my computers and things, so you can check up on me, totally. I give parole, I want to prove that it's worth coming back together again. Because that can sometimes work. We did that with a couple who come to Bodhinyana Monastery every week. They're about to get divorced years ago, but I said, no, parole him. In other words, give him a year, and he has to make sure that you see his all his emails, all his no secret passwords, and so you can actually learn how to trust him again, because he broke that trust, and it worked. I see them every week, no, when I'm there, that is. So anyway, that's a possibility. Forgiveness, sometimes you can't, you've been hurt, can't trust them. But give them that nice parole, ways that they can earn that trust back. People are usually very good. All these years I've never seen a really bad person. Actually, well, I better not say who. No, there's only one person I must admit ever saw. I thought it was just, I really would not like to upset him. And he was happened to be a dictator, one of the countries where I was doing some conference. Not Sri Lanka, no, but some other place. Okay, I think that's enough. It's 6 minutes past, 7 minutes past nine. Thank you for asking those questions and at least keeping me awake when I should be really asleep. So anyway, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Excellent. So now we can actually pay respects to the Buddha, Dhamma Sangha, the Triple Gem. Three things to remember when you die. Very good. So, last time when the other monks were here, did they go straight to the... Or did they sit here afterwards?